First, let me thank the organizers, Bill, Phil, and Adrian, for this wonderful opportunity in this wonderful place, and this wonderful conference. First of all, I'd like to sort of set a stage. I mean, what I would like to do is to, or what we would like to do really, because it's been the work of a group of people really, is to get some tools, develop some tools to study a real biological molecule. And I put up a very recent paper that just appeared a few months ago in Science, and this is the potassium channel in a fly. And it's done in all detail. Now, and I must say that I'm very ignorant of biology, but I'm starting to learn. And the thing is that in this channel, if you change one amino acid, then the poor fly can't fly anymore, and it shakes. So that sort of mutation is called the shaker channel. Right, and in a recent conference in Kansas City, there were like two or three sessions dedicated to that. And the reason is very obvious, because these tiny changes, they're very interesting for, you know, medical purposes, because, you know, changing these properties of a channel can really make a certain drug work or not work. So I think the lesson to be learned is that detail in biology is very important. Another thing, for example, is if you, instead of water, drink heavy water, you're going to die in a few minutes. I mean, it's really poisonous. So that also underscores the fact that there are very delicate details that really are very important to biological function. So what I really want to do is... what I really want to do is to develop some methods. I mean, that's actually our intention. I don't know how far we are along this path, probably not very far, in studying a structure. And here is a transparency that I borrowed from Rob Colson, which shows the... this is gramicidin, that's another channel. And this is something that has their water molecules and solvent molecules. And that's a notoriously difficult problem, because even simulations nowadays cannot put everything in the picture. I mean, water and the ions, I think that's still sort of a little bit beyond what the even present days, very powerful computers can do. So what we try to do is really, and here I have to apologize because I'm going to change my title. And of course, I'm going to talk about the mean spherical approximation. And I want to sort of talk about a theory that's, first of all, not so mean. Second of all, not really spherical. And third of all, better than just an approximation. And therefore also I kind of changed my title. Instead of, so it's theme and variations on the mean spherical. And I added an S, that's not a typo, it's a scaling approximation, because the theme, and this is the work with Esau Velasquez, who is sitting here in the audience, and myself, and the theme is that we sort of want to introduce a scaling matrix, gamma, which actually is the close cousin of the biological scaling length, or screening length, or whatever you want to call it. And the variation is a variational principle. That means that we do, like many people here have done, we write down a free energy, and then we minimize it with respect to that scaling matrix. And the objective really is to obtain a reliable theory for electrolytes of arbitrary shape. I mean, that's the new thing. And of course, the work has been the inspiration, long-time inspiration of, Joe Leibovitz, Jerry Perkus, Eduardo Weissman. And the work has been done in collaboration with all of these people. And this money comes from NSF, ONR, and EPFOR NSF, and more recently DOE. So this is the outline of what we want to do. We first want to construct a electrostatic model, and the electrostatic model we represent by our system by some sort of a equivalent capacitor, and in the most approximate theory we will sort of assume that the entropy is a simple function of the scaling parameter. And what we have done is to sort of use this expression here, which is nothing but the Baeheuchel limiting law. And what we want to do is we want to satisfy exact relations while doing that. So, okay, what are these exact relations? The first one is the Stillinger-Lovett moment condition. And the Stillinger-Lovett moment condition, this simple ansatz here, this satisfies this condition. And the interesting thing about the Stillinger-Lovett condition is that if you have ions that are the size, then that necessarily implies charge oscillation in the strong coupling limit. So that's sort of a good feature to sort of explain things like, for example, why two equally charged spheres may eventually attract. Then there is another theorem that's a little more subtle, and that is a perfect screening theorem. And by the way, I mean, I have a handout of all the papers we have published, and I'd be glad to sort of hand them out at the end of the conference. So these references are all in there. So what this means is that, first of all, every charge, you know, Coulomb systems are very peculiar because of a very long range forces, and that imposes very strong, very stringent conditions on the electroneutrality. So every ion of a charge, of a positive charge, will be surrounded by an ionic cloud. And, you know, by electrostatics, you can always show that there is an equivalent capacitor, which, you know, the energy of this fellow here is going to be just always equal to the energy of, you know, some equivalent capacitor where you have a shell of opposite charge at a certain distance, E. Now, one comment that I should make is that this is not only a model for thermodynamics, but also for a structure function. Actually, you can show that the structure, the direct correlation function, can be obtained from this model by just taking two spheres and sliding one into the other. And then, the non-trivial part is that a non-spherical equivalent capacitor, it's also a metallic object, and I forgot here to sort of put it down to Earth, put it to zero, so that outside there is no field left, absolutely none. And then there is the other kind of interesting part, which is the asymptotics. And this is work that was sort of mostly done with Yasha Rosenfeld. And so you get first a low density, low plasma parameter, gamma, which is, you know, really, again, the screening length of screening square. For a low density and low coupling, we get the Baeheuchel limit, which is exact. Then we have the Onsager bounds, which occurs when you have high density and high coupling. And then there is a new kind of bound that, it's not so new, but is the sort of the binding limit. That means that when particles sort of stick to each other by some mechanism, which is the low density but high coupling constant. And the one sort of limit that is, that what it really means is that when this gamma here goes to infinity, then this sort of metal envelope sort of collapses to the hard core, and if you have a non-sphere, then it will collapse towards whatever shape you get. And the thing is that we want to sort of develop a theory that has these features. So basically what we want to do is a sort of a mean spherical scaling approximation that will sort of, in as much as possible, have those features. Now, the non-spherical, you know, the non-spherical screening approximation is not really a very intuitive thing. For example, here, this is the result of an exact calculation done with Martin Luke Rosenberg some years back. And this is sort of shows a non-spherical distribution. And in spite of what you might think, there is no dipole moment here. There is no quadrupole moment. There is no positive electric moment in that distribution. In spite of it, the fact that it's not spherical. Okay, so then let me sort of go and back and sort of describe the more sort of pedestrian work. So when you do the Bahuko theory, then it's known that you, after Mayer, that the first of all, there is a universal constant here, and following Mayer, I mean, you sum ring diagrams, right? And mean spherical approximation. The mean spherical approximation, you get exactly the same diagrams, and the ring diagrams, only that now you put hard cores into those bonds in the vertices. And all you get really is, if you compare the two expressions, I mean, all you really get is from the de Bahuckel to the mean spherical is that you get this sort of screening parameter, which is not exactly the same. And this really comes from that variational principle that I just showed. Or in other words, if you sort of do all your arithmetics following any classical textbook of physical chemistry, then you sort of do your integrals as you, and when you're all done really with the Bahuckel, this is your excess energy, and you take your entropy as being the same as the Bahuckel entropy, only that now you declare this a unknown parameter. And then you simply say, okay, now let's find the best parameter by minimization and outcome this equation here, or this equation here, and that's exactly the same thing. Okay, now that's all.
The ring diagram, are those the little ions?
Pardon me?
At the bottom, you have dots. What about the small ions?
Oh, that's a sum over every ion. And really, this expression, the general expression, there is a J here that's missing. It should be everyone has his own size. There are no point sizes. I mean, the difference between those two is that you put sizes here, and, in the other one, you have point ions.
And there's only one dotted line in all the diagrams?
Oh, I'm sorry. There are dotted lines all over the place.
The question is about the
dashed line. The dash, that's actually, it's a, well... You know, It's okay. I mean, there are really sums of hardcore plus the by lines.
So every line could be solid or it could be dashed.
And it's really the sum of the two. You know, it should be actually a wiggly line, which... Okay, now... Okay, now, I don't want to sell you the mean spherical as being the super-duper theory, because it isn't. It has problems. Now, in a nutshell, I mean, what's wrong with the mean spherical approximation? So the mean spherical approximation, you take your ion, really, and the easiest case, really, is a case where you have ions are of equal size, a restricted model, and the assumption is that your direct correlation function equals minus the potential, and that's fine if your potential is very small, if this is a small number, because this is what it really should be, and actually asymptotically in the red region, that's what it should be. And this is the region here, this actually should be here, this is the wrong region. And okay, so you want to correct with it. But it turns out that actually that's not so difficult to do. And back in 1972, we really tried something which is a soft mean spherical approximation, where we did exactly what this slide sort of suggests. Just take the inner part, this inner part, this relation, which is a Perkosiewicz closure, and then switch from this to that at a certain point, which is approximately what's shown here in this slide, about 1.1 the hard core, and you get a result which is really in fantastic agreement with there are no adjustable parameters, and furthermore, this is very insensitive. You can sort of go around here for a little while, you get... This is against computer simulation, and this work that we did with Alfred Norton. And okay, so you can actually correct it without going into much trouble. Now, okay, now there is also a sort of you can go a little bit further because. Turns out that in order to solve, well, the mathematical problem is that you want to have an easy problem in terms of expressing everything in terms of screening parameters. So basically, what you want to do is you want to see, can I solve something that's actually a little bit more interesting than just the 1 over r potential? And it turns out that mathematically, the only requirement that you have in order to be able to produce these sort of scaled solutions, and that's sort of the name of the game, is that your potential must be a Green's function of a Laplacian operator, right? And there are two of such potentials. One is the Yukawa e to the minus kr dot r, and 1 over r. And so we also played with the e to the minus kr over r. In the case of one Yukawa, you actually, it turns out that you can sort of work the whole thing through and get an equation of state, which is this one here. And for this is for an arbitrary size mixture, and the entropy in that case is a little bit more complicated than just gamma cube over 3. So, and you get something a little more complicated. And here's an example. This is rubidium. This is just the sort of a soft repulsive core. And this is compared to, I think, computer simulations. So it works very well. So, you know, when you get one cookie, you want two. And when you want two, you want three. So here we go. So let's do two Yukawas, and I'm sorry about this slide, but this is the equation that we are really talking about. And but the potential, this is a two Yukawa fluid, Now the interesting thing is that you can play that game also with this kind of a potential. And here is the entropy, and there is
you can get an equation of state, and that's in molecular physics and press.
And then you say, okay, now I got two, I want three, so here comes three. We're doing it. And then when you say, okay, three, why not water? Okay, because that's really what we want to do. And yes, you can do water. So what do you have to do with water? Well, water, actually, it turns out that your potential, you can still sort of use your e to the minus kr over r, right? So actually, the potential that you want to use is a 2u kawa, and you want to put an angular part to it. And the angular part really is very simple. It's actually an octupole. It's this equation that's up here. It's xyz over cube, and it's kind of like a soft but tetrahedral form here. And then it turns out that there is a trick, and that's a trick that we developed sort of a number of years back, which will reduce the sort of the angular part to a matrix equation. So now you have exactly the same problem, only that instead of numbers you have matrices. And the trick is to use these, what we call the irreducible representations. And that irreducible representation really means that, you know, the physics, most of the physics and the observable structure is contained into this kind of an arrangement, which is the sort of signal orbitals. And then you would say, but multipoles aren't really very good, because we know that if we take any of the standard potentials, you can't expand them very well. So we decided to do a little computer simulation and see if, you know, how well we can fit the experimental neutron diffraction data. And here you go. I mean, the line is the oxygen-oxygen pair correlation function, and the black diamonds are a soft octupole model that's an earlier version that, however, does not have an analytical solution, but it fits really as good as any the oxygen-oxygen pair correlation function for this. And the white circles, which are a little bit off, are this present model, the solvable model. And this is the oxygen-hydrogen comparison, which is not as good. Now, I think that this probably has to do with an artifact of the Fourier inversion. And then we do the hydrogen-hydrogen. And again here, I mean, it's not really all that perfect. But the point is that we can really do nice things, because it's actually, I would say, trivial to extend this to ions and water. So we can actually do the ions and water with this model without much trouble. I mean, it's been done, but it's not really ready to go.
Can you clarify where was oxygen and hydrogen? Because we showed us something.
These are the oxygen-hydrogen correlation functions. So what you have to do is you have to sort of take the spherical harmonics up to the octupole, and then you have to write an equation that I can show it to you. I mean, and you get oxygen-hydrogen. I mean, it's properly done. You should believe me. And it's in press in Physica A, so it's going to appear a couple of months in Physica A. So, and then there is an article which already, this has been done for a non-analytical model, and actually the references are here for that. Okay, so Let's now then go back to the primitive model. And in the primitive model, what we want to do now is, well, there is one thing. I mean, the mean spherical approximation, or really any approximation, and call it the hypernetic chain, a reference hypernetic chain, Rogers-Young, or you can go through all. Turns out all of these approximations, they're really based on the Ornstein-Zernick equation, the regular Ornstein-Zernick equation. And it was Michael Wertheim who noticed that if you have forces that are extremely very, very strong so that you really produce dimers, then that doesn't work. And the reason is very simple. And you take, this is standard statistical mechanics, Gram canonical pressure equation and Gram canonical density equation, and then what you normally would do is sort of assume that those series are convergent, and then simply extract the density, substitute the density, and you get your variable equation. But that will not be okay if you are in the following conditions. Your fugacity goes to zero. Well, this is the low density, and that's what I just said, right? Now, this doesn't happen if one of your J's, you have J particles that form a J-mer, a polymer, and now you go to, you take Z to zero, but you assume that one of these J terms is finite, while all the rest, all of the other terms from this sum go to zero, and then you get from those same equations that number one, this is your pressure, and this is your density as a function of the fugacity, and out comes this correct limiting expression for the pressure for a J-mer. That means that if you have three guys who are stuck together and you count the densities of the monomer, then your ideal gas equation must be the density divided by three. And so the Wertheim-Ornstein-Zernick equation, which is the Ornstein-Zernick equation, I didn't remember that I had an Ornstein-Zernick equation here, but I do. All you have to do really is to sort of put the chemistry back in. That's the Wertheim sort of thing. And these are your dissociation constant that you compute using a dissociation constant. And really all it means that in your rings, you're now substituting your densities by these matrices, right? And then you sort of work out the thing. Turns out that you can, the most remarkable thing about the thing is that you work a lot, it's really a lot, to sort of get all the solutions, but most interestingly, all the thermodynamics. And it turns out that your entropy turns out to be, even for this complicated model, exactly the entropy of the de Baer-Huckel theory. So, now you work a little more. And this work with Jean-Pierre Simonin and Olivier Bernard of the University of Paris. These numbers here are really very close to experiment. This is a fitted number of 60. The experiment isn't that far away. And this is a very high number. And you put more or less what crystallographic sizes you know of these complexes. And then you get the osmotic coefficient of sulfuric acid between almost zero to pure sulfuric acid. So there's very little fitting here going on. And then you can sort of go on and do nitrates here. Again, same thing. Sorry, this is the way. The size of the nitrate is the same. And then you can do all these series of salts. And this is the sort of the fitting constant, and this is the one that's in the literature. And you see those numbers are not very different, and you fit really within a few percentage.
Can you just tell us exactly this equation that you are using? You basically have an equation for MSA, but with association.
That's right, yeah, yeah. And you sort of, but the interesting thing is that, well, there are two things that you fit. I mean, one is the dielectric constant, which changes. Right, that's another story. But then you can also change it against experiments. I mean, these are not free parameters. I mean, it turns out that you put all the correct measured parameters and you fit the properties beautifully. And not only do you fit the equilibrium properties, you fit with more or less the same numbers the diffusion constant and transport constant. So the whole thing's kind of, you know, somehow sort of gels into something that seems to be a rather correct and very simple theory.
And the position you get from the theory, you don't put the number of...
No, that's what I'm showing. I mean, the association there, the things that are reported in the literature. So here it's different, but in many cases, I mean, you would see that by and large, I mean, these things are... or more. But let me sort of continue, because there is some mathematics in it. Because, well, again, it's the chocolate. If you have two, you want three. If you have three, you want four. If you have four, well, you want n. So you can actually do linear polymers with this, and you work it all through. Turns out that your gamma, again, this is the excess entropy, is gamma cubed over 3. And, okay, so when you work it all out, and again, references, this is all published work, and it's been done the hard way, everything. But what you want is that when you're all done and you take the limit of perfect association, then you want that this expression here, which has a lot of complicated things, will, at infinite dilution, will produce the Baer-Huckel theory, in which you get the ionic strength will be the charge of this polymer square, right? So it turns out that to do that...
How do you control the degree of polymerization?
Okay, that's in the details. You know, here you have to put a matrix of association constants. So there are four species there, right? So one binds to two, and two binds to three, and three binds to four only. You don't let them do anything else. And then you take the limits when those associations go to infinity. So you have a chain. You can actually do, you can play different games. You can play a game of a distribution, you know, where you have monomers that have A and B sides, and monomers that have A sides and B sides. So there are different games that you can play. I still have a few things, right? So, you know, it's all taken care of. So the remarkable thing is that you get this formula here. It comes at a price. I mean, the price is the following. If you just assume first nearest neighbor interaction, then you get this correct only for the dimer. And for a trimer, instead of 9, you get 8.5, etc. But then you put three body interactions in there, just the excluded volume, and then out pops this equation, which is absolutely correct, and it's true. So, but you see, as they say in French, nul n'est parfait, nothing is perfect. So you really, here you get a polymer very nicely, but there is one limit that really doesn't really come out very well, and that is, you know, so for low concentration, repeat, it works very nicely, but in the high density, high gamma limit, all of these things, they give you back the fully dissociated limit. So it doesn't know it is a chain. The MSA with the association doesn't know it is a chain when you go to the high limit. So, and that's exactly what we really wanted to sort of do with the work that we are doing with
practice of Velázquez, which is, well, you know, there is something wrong in this formulation, and the wrong formulation is that, and okay, let me also put up, this is not our own work, this is the work of Jiang Wenjiang, who is now visiting Professor Prosser in Berkeley. They did simulations, and I think the simulations are of Kramer and Stevens, I believe. But it's a very closely related method. So this is it. Okay, so now here we go. We want to do the non-spherical objects, right? And the dimers. Okay, so, well, okay, so we will assume that the equivalent capacitor is more or less this object here, right? So we have two spheres. The charges could be positive or negative. And if we do it the hard way, this is what we get. But this will, as said, will not give us the proper limit. The high density high coupling limit does not come out right here. So what we do is simply that. We just say, okay, let's now assume that our energy has this form, right? And C is the capacitance of our two intersecting spheres, this object here. And then we kind of increase it by gamma, by this number here. So this is our energy. And it turns out that we found a reference. There was a certain James Clerk Maxwell who solved that problem. And it's in the book. I think up here in the library there is his book. But, well, he solved it not in a very clear way. And there are other people who sort of got the mathematics so everything is convergent and nice and easy. And this is the expression here. And, okay. Now, what we did is to sort of solve an example. And it turns out that you can actually cook up a fairly easy and fully analytical expression for a dimer in which this is a dimer, the blue spheres are the dimer, and the counter ions are of three sizes. This is 1/5 of this size, this is when they are of equal size, and this is when they are 5 times bigger. So the distance of closest approach really is represented by the center-to-center distance of that, and so you can actually do the thing. And so we have the screening parameters, what gamma turns out to be in terms of kappa, and when you go out this will kind of level off because it looks and it is fairly similar to a square root. I mean, the screening parameter in the MSA is about the square root of the Debye parameter. And so we have the axis. This is the, you know, if you assume spheres, then this is kappa, the Debye parameter. And this is the screening parameter that comes out of this MSA, this variational MSA. Okay? And these are the ratios. I mean, so this would be the big sphere, the equal size sphere, and the small sphere. Okay? And so here comes the capacity. That's the ratio of the capacity of the small sphere compared to the spherical case, in which you completely neglect this, the sort of non-sphericity of the dimer, the cation. And okay, and then here's the thermodynamics. So we get, actually, turns out that these really are the same curves except for a shift, because since we started off with a entropy that's kind of universal, the entropy is the same for all three cases. And I think that's all I wanted to tell you, and thank you for your patience. Say it again, please.
I think it's called the Yukawa model of Yukawa with water. You're showing the
yeah. Right, yeah.
I'm wondering if the way the anisotropy was put in meant that all waters were oriented.
Oh, okay. Okay, yeah. Let me sort of pull up that transparency, and I'll tell you exactly what's been done. Because it's you know, there's a lot to it. Okay. This is a potential of one water molecule, right? That sits there, and the other one you just take the center of that, right? But that is not really the whole potential. That's kind of a pictorial way of putting it. So you have this water here, and you have the center of the four others that you want to be sitting in the tetrahedron. Now you have the orientation of the second molecule. So in the potential, you really use a product of this, of one molecule, by the other one. So it's not, this is not the whole potential. Right? So that's, and then, yeah, and then you need some other little pieces to really make the hydrogens look into these lone pairs. But you know, this is the kind of the essential part of the structure. You know, you need all of these pieces to get really this very, rather, I think, remarkable agreement with experiment, because, before doing that, I wouldn't believe that octopoles would sort of be able to do the job. And there are like two or three coefficients, not more.
Concerning the multi-Yukawa model, could you focus on the phase diagram?
Well, all of these things, they happened last year, so we are working on it. But
I pick up a little bit on his previous question. As the decision comes as an input to the theory, let's say, if you have a model, let's say, primitive model, do you still need to give the theory what is the dissociation constant, or that's something that comes out with the theory?
Okay, the way this is set up, I mean, the answer is yes and no. What you really need to do is you need to tell the system that there is an association, and you can actually derive it from some closure of the Ornstein-Zernike equation, right? Now, what is in there is that, you know, there is a, you know, the dissociation constant between two ions has two parts. I mean, one is the actually glue, the sticking part, but then there is also the contact probability. So what's in there is that the contact probability is computed using the exponential approximation. And when you do that, then really the whole thing really, you know, simplifies. It's unbelievable. You know, because otherwise you have these T sticking parameters. But here we have a sort of more or less honest-to-goodness Bjerum, if you wish, or generalized Bjerum theory, in which you have an exponential stickiness, exponential contact correlation, and a stickiness parameter. And, well, so, and it really gives some sort of a Debye-Falkenhagen theory of, form of the dependence of this dissociation constant with ionic strength, right? That's sort of an old result, and it really works very well, and that's what's been done.
What do you use as the geometric constant of functional distance? Because your structure capture has no very
Well, in the adjustments that were shown here, we use a dielectric constant that is a function of concentration. Let me come to that. Okay, you can also play this game actually with the multiples, everything. But it has been played with this work that we have done over the years with Fernando Vericat, who is in Argentina, and is also a co-worker in this paper. You derive the you actually do this whole game. You play with the ions and with those structures. So you get a pair correlation function between the ions and those molecules. So you get the whole thing in there. And then when you do your thermodynamics, you come up with a dielectric constant that is indeed dependent on the concentration. Now, there has been somebody in Davis, Ron Fawcett, who has done the following thing. He said, okay, I don't believe your mean spherical for ions and dipoles, right? Because if you do that, you come up roughly with the same dependencies that are fitted here. So he took experimental data from Bartel's group in Regensburg, and he fits us beautifully. I mean, the parameters are not exactly the same, but everything that we more or less fitted, he can fit again very well. So it's a very consistent picture, and it, you see, the fact that your potential oscillates with a distance translated into this sort of equivalent capacitor model, which still is valid for the non-primitive model, translate into a dielectric constant that depends on concentration. That's what happens. And that concentration dependence is not really free, and it's sort of, you can compare it to experiment and to mean spherical approximation and those kinds of, it's very consistent.
What is the distance dependence of the dielectric constant?
That was my question.
Well, he didn't mention one. You were the one who mentioned it.
Well, when the two ions get close together, you're going to have a couple of water molecules between them. If you can talk about that, the constant of water. When you're getting less than a molecule, the water molecule between
okay.
them.
Okay.
Well, if he wants to treat that properly, he would have to treat the water molecule separately.
Right.
Otherwise, he would use, and I think that's what's implicit because he had epsilon zeros, he either assumes he's treating all the molecules that way or he's doing the Debye approximation with his uniform background.
Right.
Right. So yeah. Can I maybe answer your question? I mean, the dielectric constant is a bulk property. It's not a property of a distance.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's, but what's a local property is a polarization. And that you get out of this, and it's an oscillatory function. But you need two polarization components to sort of compute your dielectric constant. If you want to define a local one. Pardon me?
It becomes not a two-body problem.
Oh, it's right. Well, it, you know, we can talk about it, but it's...
I actually had a question of the lesser, which confuses me. You mentioned that in your generalized MSA, you have the parameter gamma, and then you determined it, you had an equation, the AD gamma equals zero, by a variational principle. And variational principles are often used in chemical physics because they sound appealing, but some of them don't have a derivation fundamental.
Okay.
And I'm confused on the basis here.
How fundamental? Okay. There is a 1970 or 72, maybe Derek knows exactly the date, by Anderson and Chandler.
Yeah, I know the gentleman.
Right, okay, or Chandler and Anderson. I think that's. And they have shown that the sum of the ring diagrams is equivalent to a variational principle.
Well, when I asked Chandler about that, he never made the claim. But
well, it's written, and he didn't deny it when I talked about it in a recent Water Gordon conference, and I said, and this is, you know, a concept, and I can actually show it. I mean, that the ring diagrams, if you do the ring diagrams and do the general variation, you know, of the... Okay, so
So, and this is just a corollary because we have just one parameter. It's a one parameter or n parameter theory. But you can do it if you don't believe it, and that's what I did. I never believe anything, and I try to do it the hard way. You do it the hard way, you get the same answers.
Lester, can I ask a question? There are a few cases where you can get exact results for Coulomb system, and one case, the two-dimensional, two-component Coulomb gas with positive and negative charges, where you have a high-temperature conducting phase where the biological theory is supposed to work, the cost of the star distribution and the insulating phase. Suppose you use the mean spherical approximation for that case.
For that case.
Can you predict reasonably correctly the locus of the metal or the...
Okay, let me sort of start off by saying that because of the, you know, there is a dimensionality problem, which is the following. You cannot solve exactly you cannot solve in a mean spherical approximation, that's probably the correct statement, any system that is in even dimensions. So two dimensions we cannot solve. So although we can claim that the variational principle is correct in two dimensions, we don't have the comparison of the other way of doing it. Because every one of these things has been done both ways, right? And we just checked that they give the same results. So that's what we've done. Now the two-dimensional Coulomb gas, I would strongly suspect that this thing is not going to work at all. Well, the biological works, Well, but I have no claims about two dimensions. You know, I have no claims about two dimensions. I don't know. I mean, we have done it.
Well, the essence of the MSA is twofold. One is the simplicity of the closure, which is then known to work well as regards hard spheres alone. It's more debatable what happens. And the other is the fact that it is tractable, which is really important if you want to use these things, and that, as Lester says, you're restricted because of the Bessel function being nasty in the even dimension.
That's right, exactly. So you have really singularities that are branch cuts, and those are very hard to deal with.
Rather, continue on with the next speaker. So let's thank Lester.